This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. Marlene Zuck is a professor of biology at the University of Minnesota, her main research interest being behavioral ecology, the study of the evolution of behavior. Her research centers on sexual selection and the effects of parasites on mate choice and the evolution of secondary sex characters. Marlene Zuck is the author of Sexual Selections, What We Can and Can't Learn About Sex from Animals, and Sex on Six Legs, Lessons on Life, Love, and Age from the Insect World. And her latest book is Paleo Fantasy, What Evolution Really Tells Us About Sex, Diet, and How We Live. So, Marlene, welcome to Little Atoms, first of all.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into the book, I'd like perhaps to talk a little bit more generally about your research. So tell us some of the things that you're doing.
Most of my research right now centers on insects, and I do a lot of work on how animals cope with novel traits. So the population of crickets that I study most of the time is in Hawaii, and they've had a recent, very rapid evolutionary event occur. So I've been working a lot on that, and that's probably most linked to the book itself and why I got interested in rapid evolution in general.
And we'll talk about that particular example when we get onto that a bit later then. So let's talk about some evolutionary myths, really, because in this book you explode quite a few myths and ideas about evolution. The obvious one being, first of all, that it's a slow process.
Partly that it's a slow process, but also that it's a process that's sort of proceeding towards something. And I think that's probably the biggest myth that people have that often goes unconsidered. And you see that in all these cartoons and other drawings or pictures about evolution, where they're invariably showing a progression of one life form to another. So they'll have, some of them will show a fish in the water, and then there's the, frog or some other amphibian that's clambering onto the shore, and then followed by maybe a reptile, and then some kind of four-footed mammal, and eventually there's an ape or a monkey, and always at the very end of this, toward the far right-hand side, there's a human being. So the first human being is always standing very upright, looking sort of noble and off into the distance, often clutching a spear. But in the more modern versions, you'll get maybe a guy that's kind of paunchy and slouched over, and, instead of having a spear, he's got, a hamburger, or maybe he's slouched over a computer or something, and the idea is that he's unfit and kind of fat and unhealthy, and the implication is, what have we wrought? And, I mean, those cartoons are funny, and, I like them too, but they really contain in them a lot of what's a misapprehension about the way evolution works. So for one thing, they make it seem like one form kind of replaces another. So that it's like cars, where the newest version, the version from this year, is of course better than the version from last year, which was better than the version from the year before, which of course is what the car manufacturers want you to think, so that you'll go buy a new car every year. And, by and large, even if you don't buy a new car every year, there is this generally accepted idea that, the 2013 cars are better than, say, the 1955 cars or something. I mean, we can generally assume that, yes, you've been improving steadily as things have been going on. And so there's this implicit assumption that that's how it works with evolution. But that's not the case. In the first place, of course, reptiles didn't replace amphibians, which didn't replace fish. We've still got reptiles, fish, and amphibians around all the time. Plus, we've got apes. We don't have any of our own close relatives of humans around anymore, but that's just due to a variety of causes. And it's not because evolution has been slowly progressing toward some pinnacle, which happens to be human beings. And so we feel like, oh yes, we've been working really hard to get here. Now we've gotten here, we've made people, and now we're done. And that's just not how it works. All of the organisms, all of the living things that are alive right now are just as evolved as all of the other living things that are on the planet right now. So it's really a mistake to think that human beings were kind of where everybody was trying to get to. It's not like, chimpanzees are kind of a failed relative of people, where, they were trying to get to people and then oops, they kind of made some slip up at the end and ended up with all that fur and running around in the jungle. And that's just not how it works.
But I guess, of course, it's anthropomorphism that it says that have worked out evolution. It says that have drawn the cartoon. So the human beings are putting themselves at that pinnacle. It'd be interesting to see into the future with some perhaps bigger-brained human or something, or alien life form further on.
Well, right, and you know, again, there's this idea that, okay, and what's going to happen next, as though there was a direction, you know, as though we're just going to keep on making cars and the car manufacturers are going to keep on being more clever. But, of course, there is no manufacturer here, and that's sort of the point about evolution, that you don't have anybody that's structuring the way we're moving toward a particular goal. And I think that's, we end up in these blind alleys where we say, oh, well, but so, you know, why hasn't evolution done a better job of this, that, or the other thing? Well, that's not how evolution mm-hmm. works. It's not moving toward perfection. And those latter cartoons that I mentioned, the ones where, you know, the guy is clutching the cheeseburger or, you know, slouched over the computer, that doesn't really represent any sort of deviation from the way things are supposed to be, because things weren't supposed to be any way at all.
Let's talk about the idea of the timescale then, because as I mentioned before, people have this idea that evolution is something that takes place over thousands, if not millions of years. And indeed, this is the thesis of this book, this idea that human beings should be looking at cavemen because the modern world is the modern invention.
And there's absolutely some truth to that. And I think that's part of the allure of this idea that, you know, sure, at first principles, it makes sense. And it actually is the case that, you know, we evolved, human beings evolved over a long period. And, you know, it took a long, long time for, you know, it did take millions of years for us to move from being, you know, four-footed creatures to being bipedal creatures. And then, you know, it took a long, long time to go from being bipedal creatures to then ending up talking into computers and, you know, and having the opportunity to, you know, to buy a fast food hamburger. Or whatever. And so, yes, absolutely. All of that, you know, it takes a very long time. And so it's on the surface, it's reasonable to say, oh, well, and therefore, if we do so many things now that are modern, that seem like they're ill-suited to the environment that we were living in for a long time, it's going to be bad for us. But the problem is that you can't always see the changes that have happened. And furthermore, it's a mistake to assume that anything was perfectly adapted even way back then. And this gets back to this idea about the misapprehension about evolution generally, that it's not like we're evolving to become more and more and more perfect, and then finally we can be finished and say, oh, phew, we're done with that, and now we can all go off and, you know, learn to knit or something because we're finished with all that nasty evolution stuff. Instead, organisms are changing quickly or slowly, depending on the circumstances, and sometimes they end up not necessarily being what we would call better at all. I mean, we think about this business of becoming bipedal, right? Mm-hmm. So human beings are on two legs, whereas, you know, virtually all of our other mammalian relatives are on four. Well, you could argue that becoming bipedal was just a dreadful mistake because there's lots of downsides to it. Walking around on two legs, first of all, you don't run as quickly. Second of all, you can have a lot of back problems. It makes it difficult to give birth to infants. There's lots of things about it that are really not, you know, such a fabulous idea if you want to think about it from first principles. But because there wasn't anybody directing the process, things just happen because at the time they are good enough. Things that work better than what else is around them end up persisting. And that's all it takes. Mm-hmm.
So I like to think about evolution happening the way that François Jacob, who is a French Nobel Prize winning scientist, talked about a number of years ago, where he said that evolution is a tinkerer and not an engineer. And what he meant by that, if you think about how a tinkerer or an engineer would build something, they go about it very different ways. The engineer says, all right, I'm going to make a bridge, and so I need to have all of the parts made specifically so that they'll be perfect for that purpose, and I'm going to have the people who are going to be trained in bridge part building and so forth. But the tinkerer is just sitting around in the garage building something that could work as a bridge, but is going to have to be made from the components that are lying around in the garage. And so maybe it'll be a bit of a bicycle and, you know, some ball bearings and an old cardboard box and various other bits and pieces that are just what's to hand. And so it might function as a bridge just fine, but none of the original part were built with a bridge in mind, so to speak. And so similarly, what that means is that we walk on two legs, but our two legs and the way we walk are all based on our ancestors, and the way our pelvic and our legs fit together has to do with the way a four-legged animal's legs and pelvic girdle fit together, because that's the starting point. And so we're carrying around all of these leftovers and jury-rigged parts from our evolutionary history.
Let's talk then about the examples that you look at in the book about how evolution has happened rapidly. times we're talking about just a few generations, not even thousands of years.
Well, I think one of the really exciting things happening in evolutionary now, increased recognition that while, of course, major changes take a very long time, it's not like, you know, with four generations later, there'll be a mammal, but instead that some things change very quickly, some things change very slowly, and again, you're always working with the parts that you had. So this idea that, oh, we are, or any other organism, is ever perfectly adapted to the environment, and therefore any change is going to be a disaster, is just not understanding the real richness of what's happening. I keep telling people this is a really exciting time to be an evolutionary biologist because I think there's a lot of new discoveries coming about, partly because of new technologies, new ways of understanding the genome that are letting us really see these processes happen, leave signatures in the genomes of organisms that are alive today.
Let's look at some examples then. So there's an example of a colony of sparrows in New England during a very harsh winter, which was particularly good.
Oh, yeah. So, of course, scientists actually have known for a long time that evolution can happen quickly. And we've known about it from some really, you know, kind of humble, simple examples. And one of my favorites is sparrows in New England that were studied over a century ago in 1898 by Herman Bumpus, who was a professor of zoology at Brown University. And so what happened was that in February in 1898, there was a really terrible storm, a really bad winter storm. It was very cold. Lots of snow, and of course that was bad for a lot of birds, and so Bumpus somehow got into his possession, I think it was 137 dead or kind of sickly dying English sparrows, which have been introduced from the UK into North America a long time ago. And so he kept them indoors for overnight and found that a portion of them survived and then flew off the next morning and the rest died. And so, well, two things to point out here. One of them is that I've never been able to figure out, like, why it was that he got given, and it says in his paper that he was given 137 dead or dying sparrows, and it's like, you know, this is not something where you're just walking along the street and you say, oh, look, here's a sparrow, old Herman, like, looking at all 137 of them, really, you know, this is not a trivial task. And so, you know, you wonder, did someone know about this? Who was it, and why is their name not in the paper that Bumpus published? Anyway, I've always felt firmly that there was a backstory here that no one's ever recognized. But regardless, what Bumpus was able to do is to just measure things about bill and body size of the sparrows that lived and compared that to the bill and body size of the sparrows that died. And he realized there was a big difference, that sparrows that were either very large or very small didn't seem to make it, whereas the ones in the middle were more likely to survive and fly off to deal with another storm. Well, what that means is that he witnessed natural selection in action. It really happened overnight because, of course, the sparrows with the too large or too small bills and bodies were not going to reproduce their genes for the too large or too small bills and bodies into subsequent generations. And so we're going to see a change in the genes for the different body size characteristics over time. And that's what evolution is. And it literally happened overnight.
We've now been able to enact in experiments evolution over just a few generations. You talk about one particular experiment in the Caribbean with some guppies.
There's lots of examples now of how we can observe evolution happening in the wild, maybe not under specific circumstances. And so, for example, guppies, you know, the regular little aquarium fish that people keep because they've got, you know, colorful tails and so forth, are really good examples of this because they live in streams that do and don't have predators in them in parts of Trinidad and other parts near South America. And so they are in these streams, some of them have predators, some of them don't, and imagine that you're in a population where there's a risk that you're going to be eaten before very long. In that case, it probably is advantageous to grow up relatively quickly and reproduce yourself before the predator has a chance to end up eating you. On the contrary, if you're in a population without a lot of predators, then there is so much of a pressure. I mean, there's other things that are going to kill you, but they probably won't be voracious other fish predators that are in the same stream. And so David Resnick, who is a scientist at the University of California, Riverside, where I used to work, did a really clever experiment in which he actually introduced predators into some streams where they hadn't occurred. And what happened was that over a relatively small number of generations, the guppies that now face this pressure from predators evolved a different life history. They matured at a younger age and a smaller size, and they had their offspring at a younger age and a smaller size. So the whole way that that species interacted with its environment was different and had evolved because of the introduction of the predator. And there's lots and lots of occurrences of this happening all over. So, you know, you may not think you're very interested in what happens with guppies because really they're just aquarium fish and who cares how many days they live. But what's really important for humans is with fish that we use for consumption. And now scientists talk about something called fisheries-induced evolution, which means if you have fish like cod or salmon that are being heavily exploited for human use, well, we're acting just like the predators on those guppies. So imagine, for example, that we're taking the largest fish, which is what we do because the largest fish are going to be the most profitable, and, you know, people want to eat the large fish. No one wants, you know, a salmon that's as long as your little finger and being convenient to fillet, for example. So, all right, so we keep taking out the largest fish. What that does is impose selection on the fish population to get sexually mature and reproduce early, smaller size. Because, of course, the fish that can manage to do that will reproduce before caught, since fish keep growing as they're getting older. And so all of a sudden, or actually over a relatively short duration, there aren't those large fish anymore, not because we've removed the individuals, but because the fish in general aren't getting to such a large size. And we've exerted this change in the entire salmon or cod or what have you population. So this is becoming of increasing concern to people who want to maintain the world's fisheries, and it's because of evolution happening in a very short period of time.
Just to finish this section off then, can you tell us about the example that we mentioned at the beginning of the show, which is your own study of the crickets in Hawaii?
I originally got interested in rapid evolution because I was working on crickets that have been introduced to the Hawaiian Islands from somewhere else in the Pacific. They're found in northern Australia and places, islands like Fiji, Tahiti, Samoa, and so forth. In Hawaii, but only in Hawaii, they're subject to a parasitic fly. And the fly can hear the males calling and then goes over to them and deposits these larvae that burrow inside, feed off of the male's tissue while he's still alive, and eventually burst out in this very, you know, creepy science fiction-like fashion, then pupate in the soil and become an adult fly. I got interested in this not just because it was creepy and science fiction-like, but because it suggests a way in which two different kinds of selection are going to interact. So on the one hand, from the standpoint of a male cricket, calling is their whole reason for living because calling is what attracts the female over. That's what's going to enable a male to get a mate. And so from an evolutionary standpoint, that's all that matters. That's how he passes on his genes. But in this case, the exact same signal that makes the males able to succeed in mating is also posing a deadly threat because it attracts the fly. And so I was interested in how, you know, what happens when you have these two forces acting in opposition to each other. And I worked on that for a number of years. And then, first on the island of Kauai, but now also on the island of Oahu, I noticed that a mutation that made the males unable to call had spread in the population very suddenly. So within less than 20 generations on Kauai and within probably less than, say, 10 or 15 generations on Oahu, we saw that a lot of the males have wings that lack the structures that usually enable a male to call. So it wasn't that they were just behaving, you know, they weren't just kind of shutting up. They were literally unable to produce a song. That's great from the standpoint of protecting them from the fly, and it does them from the fly, but of course it poses an obvious question about, you know, well, then how are they managing to find females? And so that's a lot of what my research lab's been concerned with over the last few years, is understanding what happens when you have this rapid evolutionary event and, you know, how it is that that's accommodated in the population, and, well, why do we still have those crickets out there?
How are they dealing with the loss of the singing? How do they find them in females?
The answer is turning out to be somewhat more complicated than we had thought, but it looks like what's happening is that there was pre-existing plasticity or flexibility in their behavior that meant crickets who didn't call also weren't hearing a lot of song. And so if you are a cricket, it turns out, and we've discovered this through a bunch of different both field and lab experiments, if you grow up in an environment without a lot of song, then you're going to be much more likely to move toward any of the few calling males that you hear. And in all of these populations, there's still some callers that remain. So the non-calling individuals move toward the calling individuals, and the females are able to encounter them when they do that. And it's what's called satellite behavior. It happens in lots of animals where there are territorial males or displaying males, and then there's also other males that follow what's often called an alternative reproductive tactic, where they lurk around the peripheries of the territory, or they sneak in at the last minute and try to mate with females or something like that. So it looks like this mutation kind of happened to occur in populations that were already able to accommodate it, and then that's made me wonder a lot about how new traits get established in general, and that's a lot of what we're working on. But the bottom line for what we're talking about here is that I was able to see evolution happening in the space of just a few years in the wild in a population where, you know, I would have at the outset said this was something that, you know, would be a death knell for the crickets.
This is Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny, and this week I'm talking to Marlene Zuk about her book Paleo Fantasy, What Evolution Really Tells Us About Sex, Diet, and How We Live. So Marlene, I guess there's a central idea behind the book. This paleo era of human development is seen as something as a golden age.
Yes, I think it represents, well, partly it represents just the idea that people are nostalgic for things that happened a long time, whether you want to call a long time your own childhood or, you know, the 1950s or 10,000 years ago or, you know, any other period. So I think, you know, we all tend, you know, the ancient Romans were tutting about the fact that, you know, kids today just didn't understand, you know, the real good things about life and, you know, so forth. But when it comes to evolution, I think it gets tied up with this misconception that we have evolved to be in this perfect place and that any time we deviate from that, it's bad for us. And so that, you know, shows up in lots and lots of different areas in life. But again, it's got this mistaken assumption we were ever perfectly adapted to anything, whether that was 10,000 years ago, 100 years ago, or 20 years ago.
But it's interesting that that period is seen as the point where, I guess, we went wrong with human development, and not necessarily when we came down from the trees or when we came out of water or something.
Well, yes, although arguably those points would be just as good. I, you know, one of the things I've often told people is, you know, well, can you imagine that if people thousands of years ago knew about how evolution worked, would they have seen that there was a tendency to go from scavenging on carcasses that were abandoned by other predators, like, you know, lions, or stealing food from those hunters, to hunting ourselves? And there's lots and lots of theory and lots of interesting evidence about, you know, how humans became hunters. But, you know, should we have been distressed at moving from scavenging to hunting? Because after all, scavenging was how we'd evolved. We'd evolved as scavengers, and scavenging was, you know, a fine, noble pursuit and, you know, something that everyone in the group was doing. And now all of a sudden, you know, there was this nasty, newfangled going after things with pointed objects and sticking them with it. And maybe that was just a terrible idea. And of course, if you put it like that, it sounds kind of absurd. But there's no more reason to pause at some other point than there would have been to have paused when hunters.
So in the book, you look at this modern trend of Paleolithic diets, the idea that you could have a diet we should eat in the same way that cavemen did. So tell us what we mean when we say a paleo diet, typically.
So people mean different things by it. And so the first thing I have to do is start out the same way I always start out when I'm talking about diet with this, which is to point out I did not write a diet book. I don't really care what people eat. Or, I mean, I suppose I care what people eat, but, you know, not in sort of a scientific sense. And so I've gotten lots of emails or outrage responses from people who point out that they stopped eating junk food and started eating lots of meat and vegetables or, you know, what have you, and now they feel much better and healthier. And so, you know, how can I say that paleo diets aren't good for you? And it's like, not my concern. So we have to have kind of the standard disclaimer here of that's great, and I think people who are eating things or in a way that makes them feel better should. But having said that, this idea that you have that there's a particular diet that in the first place you can determine that you know how people were eating 10,000 or 50,000 years ago, and B, that we can recreate that diet now, and C, that doing that would necessarily be better for us than any of the other options that are available to us as modern humans. All three of those ideas are not really based on good science.
Well, what do we think then? If we're looking at it from somebody who's writing a book about a paleo diet, what do they think that our ancestors used to eat?
Well, there's a lot of emphasis. So the idea is, okay, let's imagine that people were living in, you know, big emphasis is on pre-agriculture. So before people settled down and started using crops, particularly, you know, grains and starches as a major food source, what would people have been eating? And it's absolutely true that people 10 or 20 or 50,000 years ago were probably not relying that much on grains and carbohydrates. All the degree to which they were relying on grains and other carbohydrates is actually not certain. And increasingly, we're getting more evidence that they were using more grains than we had previously thought. But that's part of the idea is, you know, okay, that people shouldn't be consuming starches and that eating meat is better for you. There's actually different variants of this depending on who you might talk to. And most anthropologists now think that, well, if you look at both what current hunter-gatherers are eating and if you look at what evidence we have from ancestral sites where people were either preparing foods or cooking or, you know, something like that, people were eating a lot of different things in different parts of the world. They varied in how much they depended on plant material as opposed to animal material. Certainly those people whose ancestors were from Alaska and, you know, far northern Canada or far northern, you know, far in Asia were eating different foods than people in Africa. So it's hard to come up with a particular diet that is absolutely the one that everybody would have been eating.
And as you've just mentioned, that actually researchers are finding more and more evidence that we had a much more varied diet than we thought.
Partly a more varied diet and also a diet that changed the foods that were available more. Increasingly, people are discovering that early humans were actually grinding, if not actual grain, you know, the same kind of grains that we have now. But there was a real splash a few years ago when it was discovered that there were some early human sites where the people had been grinding up the seeds of plant that's related to cattails and sort of using that to make what every single news story referred to it as a primitive kind of pita bread, because I think they were sort of grasping at how to describe what this would have been like, and of course no one really knows, but they all seem to have settled on, oh, it was kind of like what you'd get if you were having a falafel sandwich. So okay, anyway, the idea being that they ground the grain up, mixed it with water, flattened it, and then cooked it on stones near a fire. This was something that hadn't been thought of before, and the question is, well, does that now radically change our ideas of paleo diets? Well, I don't know. I mean, certainly people in some parts of the world eat things and some were eating others.
One of the things that's definitely verboten for anybody that's following a paleo diet is milk. And I'm somebody who thinks a life without cheese isn't a life worth living particularly. So let's talk about why they might be wrong about the milk.
So dairy and dairy consumption is what I often tell people is kind of the poster child for modern rapid human evolution. And it is absolutely true that 10,000 years ago or longer, we're not able to consume dairy products after weaning, because that's characteristic of pretty much all mammals, that, you know, mammals drink milk when they're infants. That's kind of what makes us mammals. And then sometime after we're weaned, we lose the enzyme lactase that breaks down the sugar in milk, lactose, and it means that we get digestive difficulties if we try to drink milk. Well, then a funny thing happened about 5,000 to 7,000 years ago, which is that people were already using animals and starting to domesticate them for, not for milk, but for meat and for hides. And the way we see it happened is that in the populations of humans, a few people just happened to have persistence of the gene that enables lactase, lactase down the sugar in milk, to persist, and so it lasted past weaning, and lo and behold, those people can digest it, and they didn't have intestinal problems. Well, those people would have been at a real advantage in their population, both because they had a source of nutrition that other people didn't have, and some people suggest because they would have had a source of uncontaminated fluid, so it would have been, in effect, a water source that other people didn't have either. All right, so those few genetic variations, you know, in those few people persisted, and those people ended up surviving and having more children than everybody else, and then that meant that the population had more people that could drink milk or use dairy products in some way, which then encouraged keeping cattle or other dairy-producing animals more, and then that meant that there was even more option for individuals that could digest dairy, which then led to more cattle herding and so on and so forth. In culture coevolution, which I think is a really wonderful thing to think. It underdeps on the environment genetic change often is, that, or in some ways always is, that the environment, in this case the cultural environment of the cultural practice of herding cattle, changed the genetic composition of the population, which then in turn encouraged the cultural practice, which then changed the genetic composition even more. I think it's a really wonderful example of how we are simply not the same people that we were 10,000 years ago, and we know exactly, in this case, which genes have changed. So it's an extraordinary thing to me to think about how human evolution happened in 5,000 to 7,000 years, which is really a blink of an eye, evolutionarily speaking. And yet we can show that that's happened. One of the interesting things about the adaptation to be able to consume dairy is that it all depends on where your ancestors are from. So if you think cheese makes life worth living, then probably your ancestors are from Northern Europe. But anyway, there are also populations in Africa and other parts of the world where genes for being able to digest dairy products also became prevalent. And the really cool part about this is that although they all do the same things, the same gene that allows this to happen in the different populations. So evolution has converged on different solutions to the same problem in a process called, logically enough, convergent evolution. And that we understand this in so great detail, I think, is a real triumph of modern evolutionary biology.
There's also an idea that our diets should consist mainly of meats, as if a sort of paleo diet was almost exclusively carnivore. Now, we've already talked about how that diet would have been a lot more varied than people think. But even so, is there any reason to assume that we should be eating more meat?
Well, you know, the question of what people did eat and whether we should be doing that are, again, two separate things. You know, certainly, yes, it's likely that our ancestors were not vegan. I think it's, in fact, I feel on pretty safe ground saying they were not vegan. But does that mean that you can't be vegan and get a perfectly adequate diet? No. So it's this whole idea that you can look at what people were doing a long time ago and then say, therefore, that's the best thing for us, that I think needs some re-examination.
What about cooking then? You just mentioned the flatbread, the primitive form of pita bread, which presumably would have been cooked. And again, it's often sort of described that, and I know this would be a sort of even a more extreme version of the paleo diet, but there's an idea that even cooking our food is somehow an alien thing that we shouldn't be doing.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, which does seem to depart from the paleo diet thing. So there are people who believe in raw food. Most of them mercifully don't believe in raw meat, which is really just as well, given that there's kind of a lot of nasty things you can get from eating raw meat. But the whole idea of where cooking came along in human evolution and what effect it's had is a really fascinating one. Richard Wrangham, who's an anthropologist at Harvard, has done quite a lot of work on this. And he suggests that the invention, as it were, of cooking in human evolution was a pivotal point for what we did, in part because once you can cook foods, meat is certainly a big part of that, but it's not the only part. Once you can cook foods, you render them much more digestible. And if you can get foods that are more digestible, essentially what it does is it frees up time. It means that you can spend time doing something other than just getting through this vast bulk of stuff to eat, just so that you can extract a small percentage of nutrition from it. It also means that you can, again, eat a wider variety of foods, because there's some foods that are really completely indigestible unless they're cooked. He wrote a great book that came out several years ago called Catching Fire that I think is really well worth looking at. He also suggests that the cooking in turn led to kind of a division of labor across men and women in early human society. I'm not 100% sure I agree with him on that one, but it's a really intriguing idea. And he points to a lot of very convincing evidence that if you cook food, you are able to use a lot more of the nutrients in it, which then may well have led to human evolution of brain in brain size, because once you have a lot of concentrated nutrients, you can feed what's been called our most expensive tissue, namely our brain and nervous system.
There's also this almost civilizing idea of sitting around a campfire as a sort of thing to keep groups together as well.
Yeah, he brings that up too. And it's tempting to just sort of start fondly thinking about, oh, what it must have been like to have, you know, all of these early people kind of grunting around, you know, a circle of stones with a lovely blaze in the center. You know, it's hard to know how much of that's kind of projection and how much is actually real. But yeah, I think what it points to is not so much the issue itself of, you know, did we or did we not have campfires and were there or were there not marshmallows, but more important that things connected with, say, diet or with exercise or, you know, some of these other issues where you say, oh, well, all right, let's see, there was this small evolutionary change, then it can trigger this cascade of other changes in all kinds of things you would never imagine. So what would making your own crackers have to do with brain size? Well, maybe quite a lot.
Going back to grain and starch, I mean, you mentioned that, you know, there is a possibility that we would always have been eating some form of starch in perhaps smaller amounts. But let's look at ways in which perhaps, again, a sort of faster evolution might have happened to enable us to digest it easier. You talk about amylase, the enzyme that's found in saliva and the sort of the development of this. I think listeners may remember a few weeks ago, Mary Roach, the science writer, was on the show and we talked quite a bit about amylase in that. But let's talk about its evolutionary advantages to help us digest starch.
So one of the ways that we can think about recent human evolution is to look at the number of copies of the amylase gene that different people in different parts of the world have. And so genes often will, what's called duplicate, so you end up with multiple copies of them. And sometimes, though not always, having multiple copies means that you can do whatever it is that gene does better. And in the case of amylase, that looks like what it is. And if you look around the world at people whose ancestors historically relied more on starch, those people have more copies of the amylase gene, suggesting that evolution occurs to allow us to take better advantage of the food that we're eating. And, you know, this, of course, makes sense. And again, argues against at least this very simple application of, oh, well, you know, we weren't eating it 20 or 30,000 years ago, so we shouldn't be eating it now, because clearly our genes can change. And, you know, again, I know I keep coming back to this, but I really do want to emphasize, I'm not suggesting that therefore eating a diet composed entirely of flour and, you know, so forth is going to be just fine for us because we'll just evolve our way out of it. You know, that's not really it, but that our genomes are constantly responding to selection pressures. And so the genes that populations show now are just not the same genes they would have shown 10,000 or 20,000, 100,000 years ago.
There's another example of perhaps evolution is the sort of wrong way to describe this, but another sort of fast development in the changing patterns of our food that you talk about. And this is the composition of our gut flora, microbes in our digestive system. And you look at a really interesting example in the book, the Japanese seaweed example, I'll call it. So perhaps you could tell us about that.
Yeah. So first of all, the idea about our gut flora and fauna and, you know, what's called the microbiome is sort of the latest hot frontier in a lot of evolutionary and other science research, a lot of health-related research. The idea being that, of course, we are not alone, and that the factoid I always like to use with people is that if you count up the individual cells that are actual human cells that comprise our body, and then also the microbial cells, bacteria, and other sorts of unicellular organisms, the microbial cells would outnumber our cells by 10 to 1. So the first thing to realize is that there's a huge amount of interplay that goes on between what we consider our own bodies or our own cells and the cells of these other organisms that are completely necessary for our existence. With regard to the seaweed, what it looks like is that there are actually genes from other organisms, the seaweed in this case, that are transferred horizontally into the genomes of people that are eating this sort of food. And so that ends up being a really intimate exchange and a change to our genes that comes from what we actually eat. And it, in some ways, it's, you know, now that we know more about the microbiome, it's not that surprising to realize that what we eat affects us not just in terms of the transient digestion of, you know, oh, I, you know, had something that disagreed with me yesterday, but in a much more profound sense of affecting our genetics.
So really what we're saying there is that, you know, it's not necessarily ourselves that are evolving, it's the microbes, and then that can obviously happen very, very fast.
Absolutely, and there's evidence that, for example, the microbes of the intestinal microbes of children that are born now are very different than the intestinal microbes of children that were born a few decades ago, simply because, you know, the environment is different. And that could end up having profound effects. There's people starting to think about whether that's partly what's responsible, for example, for the obesity epidemic. I mean, it's way early to really lay that at feet, but, you know, possibly there's all kinds of subtle ways that are coming out that microbes are responsible for what we're like.
Well, to extrapolate that even further then, so, you know, my gut flora would be completely unrecognizable to a Paleolithic man.
Absolutely, yeah, and vice versa, yeah.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and this week I'm talking to Marlene Zuk about her book Paleo Fantasy: What Evolution Really Tells Us About Sex, Diet, and How We Live. So Marlene, in the book you spend some time looking at the attitudes of the adherents of a paleological outlook to exercise, and a couple of aspects of this. First of all, I'd like to look at running. There's an argument over whether or not we're natural runners, and beyond that, whether or not we're more suited to short distance sprinting or to long distance running.
Yeah, I mean, at first glance, it seems kind of insane that we would have been, and I say this, I should point out that I'm not a long distance runner, and so I think, you know, one could be forgiven for thinking that the idea that you would take off and run for, you know, 26 point whatever miles straight, you know, just seems like it's not particularly natural. And so when I started doing the research for the book, I was actually quite surprised to find that, in fact, there's a lot of evidence suggesting that long distance running is part of our evolutionary heritage. And so you can start out just by doing something quite simple, like comparing the skeleton of a human to the skeleton of either one of our ancestors or to a modern day great ape. And there's lots of subtle things, say, about the way our neck sits on our shoulders, about the way our hips and legs are connected and the way our pelvic girdle is arranged, that seem to be adaptations not just for walking. I mean, obviously we're bipedal and that requires a lot of adaptations and a lot of alterations from a more four-footed, you know, stance. But it's not just that. There's ways in which, for example, the head and neck seem to be cushioned against rapid movement back and forth that suggests that maybe early humans were in fact running long distances. So, all right, they probably weren't, you know, trying to do this in order to get a t-shirt because they didn't have t-shirts. So why would they have been doing that? And the answer might be to run down prey. So there's a bunch of anthropologists who suggest what they call the persistence hunting hypothesis, which has it that humans, well, you start out from some basic principles, which is that humans are really lousy at running quickly. So we are bad at sprinting. If you compare us with virtually any other animal on the planet, almost anything can outrun us. Certainly anything that we would be interested in eating.
So like a gazelle or something. We can't outrun a gazelle.
Yeah, right. So it would be very hard for us to beat a gazelle in, you know, a 100-meter dash. However, what we're very good at is running for long distances, and we're better at that than the gazelle because the gazelle isn't as good at offloading heat. Gazelles and most other mammals don't sweat the way humans do, and so they become overheated and they have to stop or they're basically going to keel over from heat exhaustion. If a human being can keep running after a prey animal and keep it from going into the shade and resting, you can actually run it till it's, you know, fallen over from heat exhaustion and catch up to it and kill it then. And that's what's behind this idea about persistence hunting, that humans are good at long distances and we're good at endurance. And that might have been valuable for catching prey. And then that, again, as with this business of how one small change will lead to something else, that would then have selected for better weapons, which then in turn would have allowed us to be more efficient hunters and so on and so forth. And so here, the idea that something that we did back in our evolutionary history is relevant to what we're doing now, I think really does hold up because it seems like our bodies aren't as ill-suited for long-distance running as it might appear at first glance.
So the paleo diet gurus tend to spurn long distance endurance for short distance sprints and short intense exercise regimes. That may partly be down to the fact that marathon runners tend to load up on carbohydrates when they're about to do a run. But what do they think then is the appeal of short intense exercise over endurance?
Well, I think that, you know, again, it depends on how you're envisioning what our ancestors did. And so, you know, you can envision something in which, you know, certainly it's not to say that humans weren't sprinting. I mean, presumably we were running away from predators when we had to. It's just, you know, you kind of wonder how often we really won that race and, you know, how it became more important to do other things to get away from predators rather than just to just outrunning them. I mean, the one thing that underlines a lot of this is that clearly humans were much more active than most of us in Western industrialized societies are today. So obviously, you know, it's not like sitting on the couch watching television is something that is a perfectly reasonable thing to do from an evolutionary perspective. The problem, as always, gets to be in the details. So if we were more active, is running long distances more likely to be better for us than running short distances? It's hard to know. And I think that what seems more productive to me than saying, what would early humans have done, is to actually say, well, what can we get data on what's healthier? And the bottom line on that one is, it's just healthier if you move around instead of not. There's some interesting evidence suggesting that moving around in small ways consistently all day is actually good for you, even if you're not burning a huge number of calories, because it alters your metabolism. The basic idea is that in general, sure, you can say we evolved to be much more active than we are, but to argue over the details of, you know, should we be sprinting, should we not be sprinting, should we be, you know, running four marathons a year or, you know, one marathon every decade is, I think, kind of missing the point.
Yeah, so there's this idea that the Paleolithic lifestyle was more healthy in terms of just sort of manual work and activity. But of course, pretty much all of human history right up until, you know, say even 100, 150 years ago was mostly manual labor, people actually being active. It's only very recently. So like, I could look at my own life and I'm reasonably healthy. I don't get that much exercise, but I try to do a lot of walking. I try to eat quite well, but I work in an office and I'm sitting down in an office for 7 hours a day. And then I come home and probably spend a few hours a day sitting down watching television. So there seems to be an idea nowadays that it is the sitting down that is the problem rather than a lack of exercise per se.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's some interesting evidence suggesting that some of these standing desks or, you know, something where you're walking at an extremely slow, persistent rate while you're working is actually much better for you. And so people who've looked at, if you spend, as you say, you know, so let's say you go to the gym and you work out frantically for an hour a day, but then you spend literally the other, you know, 15 hours a day that you're awake sitting in one place, that's probably not as good for you as if you had a much lower level of activity but spread out more through the day.
The final part on exercise then, and this is sort of going back to running, and again, this is perhaps a little bit of a niche of a sort of subset of people that think we should be doing more running. But there seems to be an idea that barefoot running is the better way to do it.
Oh, yeah. And this is huge, actually. And of course, all of the shoe manufacturers are trying to stay on top of this because their solution, of course, is to not tell people to run barefoot, but to say, oh, well, and you can, you know, you can replicate the barefoot experience by having these particular special and oddly equally expensive shoes to the really structured, you know, heavily padded ones that we used to tell you were essential for running 10 or 15 years ago. So, yeah, the barefoot running shoes are becoming quite popular, and I've got somewhere in the book, I don't remember offhand, you know, how many millions of dollars Nike and, you know, all these other companies are putting into trying to develop these. And, you know, again, the basic idea makes sense that, you know, human beings did not evolve wearing these heavily structured things on their feet. And so you could ask, well, how are they running? And, you know, what's going to be the best thing for our movements? And, you know, it seems logical to say from first principles that running without shoes is fine. And interestingly, it turns out that wearing the data are hard to get and, you know, not completely conclusive, but it does turn out that running with very heavily padded shoes does not seem to reduce the amount of injury that runners experience compared to wearing either no shoes or very minimalist shoes or something like that. And, you know, again, there's a lot of discussion about this because it's really hard to get a good sample, and you can't really just order a bunch of people to wear shoes or not and to do exactly the same thing and, you know, to do this for years and so forth. So there's, it's hard to get the data, but there's certainly some pretty good evidence that wearing shoes doesn't necessarily make everything all better for you, that runners are still getting injured. Now, along with that, though, is this idea of, well, so aren't you just letting your foot develop naturally if you're running on a hard surface? And yes and no. And this is a really good place to think about an important point about whether it's barefoot running or your diet or any of these other things that are influenced by evolution, that you can't ever talk about a trait having evolved sort of naturally without the input of the environment, because the environment's always there. And so shoes are a good example. So imagine a little baby. And so when babies are very young, you can buy little adorable shoes for them and put the little adorable shoes on them and let them totter around on their little adorable shoes. And then they'll wear those shoes, you know, on until they start getting bigger. And then they keep on wearing different kinds of shoes and so forth. And I think most of us would recognize that wearing those shoes changes the shape of your foot. It changes the way your foot hits the ground. It changes the way you walk. If you wear high heels, then it's going to change your gait and it's going to change your muscles and so forth. So that we're happy to accept that. But the alternative, which is that you never wear shoes and you're always going to go barefoot, isn't just the quote-unquote natural alternative, because the environment is still going to affect how your foot develops and what kind of shape your muscles take and what your gait looks like, because that's going to depend on the surface you're running on or the activities you're using your feet for. Are you running a lot? Are you walking? Are you, you know, doing all kinds of other things? Are you, I mean, one of the anthropologists I talked to about in the book, Greg Downey in Australia, pointed out that feet can do all kinds of things. People can learn to paint with their feet. If their arms are, you know, or hands are disabled, they can do all kinds of things. But that doesn't necessarily mean that our feet weren't, you know, our feet are not designed to paint. Well, I mean, you can use them for that if you want to. It's, you know, there's no arbiter up there saying, wait, don't do that. You can't possibly paint with your feet. It's a bad thing, any more than, you know, wait, you shouldn't put shoes on, or wait, you should put shoes on, or anything like that. So there's always an interaction with the environment that you're using your body in and the body itself, and there's going to be this feedback. So you can't really say, oh, we should all be running barefoot, or we should all be wearing a particular kind of shoe.
Okay, I want to move on to look at some of the paleo fantasies around sex and relationships and the family structure and child rearing. And well, what are some of the common paleo fantasies around this area? I guess the first one we should look at is monogamy, the idea of monogamy and whether it's natural or not.
Well, yes. And you know, I'll tell you, every time you get a news article where some always older male politician has been caught, you know, having an affair with an intern or cheating on, you know, his wife or what have you, inevitably some commentator will say, oh, well, but evolutionarily, we have to understand that powerful men are just designed to, you know, want to spread their seed far and wide. And so, you know, this is understandable and so forth. And so you kind of get two versions of this. One of them is that women are the ones that want to be monogamous because it's better for them, whereas men always want to just, you know, have sex with as many women as possible. And that's just in our genes. And we just all get used to that and get on with it. The alternative, which is somewhat more modern, is that, oh, but monogamy in general is just this cultural imposition. And so it's never natural for anyone. And we should all just be having sex with everyone or with each other. Or at any rate, everybody should be wanting to have multiple sexual partners. And so you see both versions of that, both rationalized from kind of an evolutionary standpoint. And, you know, so there's lots of strong language about, oh, there was one thing about, you know, how monogamy is a miserable failed experiment. I think there were some authors that referred to it like that. And the problem is that it is absolutely true. You know, again, there's always a kernel of truth here, that monogamy, in which one male and one female stay together for a long period of time and generally, you know, cooperate to rear their offspring, is indeed a rare mating system in animals. You don't see it that often. Where you do see it, however, is in cases where the offspring take an enormous amount of care to rear. And so in, for example, a lot of songbirds, which, you know, often, and I really aware that they're often not completely monogamous, but generally they're at least, you know, somewhat monogamous. You'll get a male and female cooperating because it's really hard rearing a baby bird. It takes a lot of food and you have to run back and forth all day or fly back and forth all day, bringing it worms and other insects and what have you, so that keeping the predators away and so forth. And one individual on its own can't rear the babies. Well, let's think about what other offspring might be really hard to rear and take a lot of work and require the efforts of more than one person. That would be humans.
Well, in fact, possibly the most difficult to rear and longest rearing animals on the planet, of course.
Absolutely. We spend a ridiculously long time being children. And that's true not just in modern days when, you know, it seems, you know, parents are complaining they can't ever get their 24-year-olds out of the house. But it's always been true that humans take a long time, even after weaning, in most societies, they're hanging around their families. They take a lot of work. And so if you think about this from what I often say is that, you know, people are forgetting the F word when they talk about this. And no, I don't mean that F word. I mean the word I'm talking about is fitness, which is what evolutionary biologists call leaving your genes in subsequent generations. It's not going to do any good to have lots of sexual partners and then just run off and look for more sexual partners if a woman gets pregnant, gives birth, and can't raise the baby. That's going to be your gene. If you're a man, that's going to be your genes wasted. So there has to be some way of cooperating to rear the offspring, or all will have gone to naught from an evolutionary perspective. And so this idea that, you know, men are simply not designed to be at all monogamous just doesn't hold up when you really think about what's really going on here. That sure, you're going to see conflicts about what's in whose best interest. And so it's not always the case that male and female evolutionary interests are going to be in line. That's true for humans, it's true for other organisms as well. But this idea that somehow men, you know, the whole we're from different planets, that, you know, men are always going to want to be polygamous and women are always going to want to have just one man is just not really borne out if you think about it from an evolutionary perspective. There's also some really good evidence that men, when they are paired, when they are pair bonded with a woman, which is sort of the biological way of talking about being partnered or, you know, married or, you know, what have you, that they change biologically in a way that makes it more likely that they're going to stay together and that they're going to help raise the offspring. So that, for instance, their testosterone levels will change, their other hormone levels will change. And this has been demonstrated in some really fascinating work, just looking at men who before and after they have children. So biologically, it really doesn't seem like monogamy is all that unnatural for us.
Well, you've been touching on it already, but I just want to raise this idea of the sex contract.
The sex contract is kind of the way anthropologists used to refer to male-female evolution, where the idea was that men went out and did all this difficult, glamorous stuff like hunting, and then in exchange for bringing home literally the bacon, or at least the meat, they got sex and fidelity from the woman. And so the idea being that, you know, all right, that so men were in essence paying for sex with meat, and that there was this contract of how it was all going to work out, when in fact you wouldn't necessarily have seen this under, you know, some circumstance otherwise. And, you know, there's several problems with this. And I think increasingly a lot of anthropologists have said, well, it's not that simple. For one thing, in lots of societies, we don't necessarily need to see reliance on men to bring home the essential food. Women are often doing that as well. Men can bring home food sporadically, but it's not necessarily what's often necessary. And so Kristen Hawkes, who's an anthropologist at the University of Utah, has suggested that what meat and hunting really do is serve to allow men to show off, that in fact they're kind of showing off their prowess to the rest of the group, and they're sharing the meat with other individuals and other parts of the family and so forth. So it's not just something that's happening between a man and a woman.
In this area, I saw what I thought was, well, one of my favorites of the paleo fantasy. It's just a little idea, but one that really made me laugh, was this idea that, you know, in Paleolithic times, women would have gone out and gathered berries and fruits and things and done the easy stuff like that. And a modern example of that would be going and shopping for shoes.
Oh, yeah. You know, there's the whole, you know, men like somehow. And what's odd is that men, what is it? Men hunting. So most men don't hunt anymore. So instead, for some reason, that's gotten transmogrified into watching football and other sports on television. Yeah. So there, and then women are shopping, which is kind of like gathering berries.
Yeah, or play sports.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure where they're... In some ways, the shopping and the gathering berries thing might be more reasonable, but I've never gotten the connection between the sports and the hunting, you know, other than I guess there's grunting involved. But, you know, I don't know. Yeah.
I think it's like an obvious point, but we haven't really raised yet. And I think while it applies to all of these paleo fantasies, I think with the sort of sex and relationship ones, it really highlights it, is that even if a lot of these things were deeply embedded in us from an evolutionary perspective, the other obvious thing about human beings is that we have consciousness. So basically, we can just ignore this stuff.
Well, you know, we can, although I also have a lot of sympathy and really do understand what a lot of people are trying to suggest when they point out, and this actually actually is an important point that, you know, having culture doesn't give you a get out of evolution free card. Okay? That just because you have a way of thinking about what you want to do doesn't mean that that's then going to stop influencing your genes. And, you know, herding dairy cattle is a perfect example of that. That the process of herding animals for milk is something that's cultural, right? We can decide to do it. We can decide not to do it. It's not something, you know, no one grows up with a gene that makes them, you know, go unerringly toward, you know, the nearest cow and start putting it in a pasture. It's obviously something you learn from other people, and it varies across the world and so forth. And yet, the practice of doing that has incredibly altered our genomes. And so there's always this feedback, just like with a baby and their shoes. It's always this feedback between what you choose to do and your cultural practices and the way your genes are going to change. So you can't really put everything in a neat package and say, oh, well, that's just biology over there, and we can just ignore that, and we're going to have culture over here, and it's not going to affect biology.
Okay, well, this leads us nicely on to really the last question. A lot of people do feel that culture has had some, you know, consciousness and culture has had some sort of effect on evolution, almost to the point where evolution has somehow been arrested. Steve Jones, the British biologist, is a believer in this to a certain extent. And actually, you quote in the book the brilliant biologist Jerry Coyne, writer of one of my favourite books, Why Evolution is True.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And he mentions that people always ask him, whenever he's interviewed, are we still evolving? And so I want to talk about that now, because I've interviewed Jerry Coyne and I definitely asked him if we were still evolving.
Well, and hopefully he said, yes, we are.
I'm sure he did.
Yes, because the answer is that, yes, we are. And I think, again, here, just like with, you know, a lot of these other things, you can imagine that if you start thinking about it, it can seem really unlikely that we're still evolving. And even in Darwin's time, people wondered about this, that once they got the idea about evolution by natural selection, you know, well in hand, they started thinking about, well, but what about all these things that modernization is doing to us? And there was someone who was a kind of popularizer or, you know, actually in these days, we probably describe him as almost a stalker of Darwin. His name was Lawson Tate, and he was very interested in how evolution was going to work for humans. And he was worried that modern medical care was going to compromise the culling action of selection. So the idea being that if you had people who were surviving because they were cured of some disease, whereas 100 years or 1,000 years beforehand they would have died from that disease, then they were passing on somehow kind of imperfect genes. And this idea, you know, ends up leading into eugenics and all kinds of other bizarre notions. But the underlying point, I think, is something a lot of us intuitively understand, that if we're changing who lives and who dies, and we're changing who's able to survive, produce, even with something like short-sightedness so people can wear glasses, then aren't we stopping what would have happened in a different kind of environment? And of course, the answer to that is yes, we are. We are absolutely changing the way that evolution is occurring. But I think a way to understand it is to think not just about whether or not you've made people who are short-sighted and, you know, would have died from being, you know, chased down by a saber-toothed tiger, you know, they've been allowed to reproduce and, you know, pass on their short-sighted genes. But that's certainly true, but you can still ask this very basic question. And the quote that I really like is from Mary Pavelka, who's a primatologist at the University of Calgary in Canada. And she says, really, we should rephrase, are humans still evolving, into, does everyone have the same number of children? And really, that's what it comes down to. All you need to have evolution occurring is to have differential reproduction of genes. So if genes are changing because of, you know, one's ability to outrun a saber-toothed tiger, that's one thing. But genes are changing for all kinds of other reasons too. And now we can demonstrate those changes in a way that we never could before, because we've got a lot of modern tools in genomics to be able to actually examine the genome. So we can look for evidence of selection in a very fine-grained way that we never could before. And that look is letting us see that, in fact, not only are we not having the same number of children, which, you know, we kind of already knew, but also that our genes really are changing even over the course of just a very few generations.
That's all we've got time for then. So I've been talking to Marlene Zuck, and we've been talking about her book, Paleo Fantasy, What Evolution Really Tells Us About Sex, Diet, and How We Live. So Marlene, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Thanks a lot for having me. It's a pleasure.
I'm Alison Gopnik. You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms. If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do it at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.